Finance Committee on Revenue will come to order. We will change the order of the agenda just slightly to go to a work session on bill introduction. We'll open that. For the record, and as we have said before, introducing bills does not suggest approval or acceptance of anything that's in the bill, but simply is a way to get a bill introduced for later consideration. Representative Benz?
Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills: LC 3695 dated 2/2/17 and LC 3759 dated 1/26/17.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill, or sorry, Legislative Council Concept 3695 and 3759 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Close the work session on introduction of committee bills. Let me get back to the agenda here. Colleagues, we have a public hearing set on six bills today. And because the first three are all interrelated, we'll open them together, and then we'll consider where we go from there. So we'll open the public hearings on House Bills 2273, 2274, and 2275. Chris, do you want to give us a good, thorough, and complete introduction to these bills, and then we'll take testimony? And I think DOR is up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. All three of these bills do come from the Department of Revenue, and they are related to recommendations provided by the Multi-State Tax Commission. For those who aren't for the new folks, probably the Multi-State Tax Commission is an organization of state tax agencies that promotes tax uniformity across the states. So just in order, House Bill 2273 deals with the apportionment formula. Under current law, most corporations use the single sales factor apportionment. If a corporation feels that a different method would better reflect their business income in Oregon, they can petition the Department of Revenue. And if there's an agreement on that alternative approach, then that alternative approach can be used. The language in 2273 adds to that statute in accordance with recommendations from the MTC. House Bill 2274 does two things. It replaces the word sales with receipts, getting at the sales factor, changes it to a receipts factor. And then it also has language that would move the apportionment for intangibles from the cost of performance method to the market-based approach. And in OLIS, there is also a map that I pulled from a publication that shows the difference, how different states use which method and how that's changed over time between 2008 and 2015. And then the third bill, 2275, changes some definitions. It changes business income to apportionable income. Corporations generally have two kinds of income: income that is allocated and income that is apportioned. Allocated income is generally, it might be capital gains income. It gets allocated to the headquarters. Business income is the apportioned income, and that's what all of the fuss is about, which income states can tax. And business income is the apportioned income. The suggested language from MTC just modifies that terminology from business income to apportionable income.
Does that change make any have any appreciable impact?
I think you're going to hear some of that nuance from Jeff.
We'll hear. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair,
welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Henderson, Oregon Department of Revenue. Start off here, give a little background about Oregon's involvement as an MTC member state. Oregon has been an active member of the MTC since the late 60s, and as so, we participate on several different committees of the Multi-State Tax Commission. We participated on the Uniformity Committee. That work group is tasked with developing model statutes and model regulations for the sake of uniformity amongst states, specifically with regard to taxation of multi-state corporations, those that are doing business in multiple states and subject to tax in multiple states. The goal of that commission is to fund uniformity to where the multi-state corporation's income is fairly and equally apportioned. So ideally, 100% of their income is apportioned to the states, no more, no less. The MTC undertook a project to rewrite UDITPA, which is the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act. That is model law that was adopted in the 50s, 1957, UDIPA was adopted. And UDIPA speaks to that same uniformity of taxation amongst multi-state corporations. Designed to provide a uniform and equitable method for allocating and apportioning income of a multi-state business to the various states in which it conducts economic activity. As Chris mentioned, the general approach is to separately allocate items of non-business income that is generally going to be assigned or allocated to a single state. There are exceptions to that single state allocation. And the other general principle is to apportion business income. So the MTC undertook a project to rewrite some provisions of UDITPA that had been in place since the 50s. They looked at UDIPA as a whole and identified five major areas that needed rewrite. The primary focus of the MTC was on the income producing and activity, cost of performance sourcing of receipts other than the sales of tangible personal property. Example, service receipts, intangibles. That was the primary focus of the MTC's work in this rewrite project. The other four areas that the MTC decided needed rewriting was the definition of sales that Chris mentioned. Factor weighting. The UDIPA calls for an equally weighted three-factor formula, and Oregon has since moved away from that, moved away in 1991, and in 2005 went all the way to a single sales factor. But the MTC UDIPA still calls for that equally weighted, so that was one of the areas the MTC identified. The other two areas, one was business income, changing the definition of business income, and then finally the alternate apportionment provision that Chris referenced. So of those five areas that the MTC took on as a major rewrite for UDIPA, four of those proposals are before you today. Is there a preference on where we start with these? Is this?
Well, there are only two people who want to testify, including you, on this, so I think you should do it in a way that you would consider organic. Remember that these are complex topics, and the committee probably needs as much background as you can give us.
Okay, very good. House Bill 2275 includes a proposal to change the definition of business income to apportionable income. There were two intents. Mr. Chair, is it okay if I go to 2275?
Please, yes.
Very good, thanks.
Yeah, all three of these bills are open, so you can address them in the way that you find most likely to be understood by the committee.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
House Bill 2275, again, changes the definition of business income. It has two intents with that revision. One was to clarify that the test for business income includes two separate tests. One is a transactional test that would include receipts derived from the ordinary transactions of a business. The other test is a functional test, and those are receipts that would be derived out of the function of the business, focuses on the relationship of the property that produces the income to the taxpayer's regular business operations. An example of the functional test income would be something unrelated to the normal transactions of your everyday business, possibly the sale of business assets used in the regular course of a business, but it's the sale of those assets would meet the functional test. And again, these two tests are geared at identifying, defining business income. And why that's important is business income is subject to apportionment by the states. Everything else, non-business income, is allocable. And generally speaking, it will be allocable to a single state. There are a few exceptions where it would be allocable to more than one. That's why this definition is important. It gets to what income is part of the corporation's tax base to be apportioned amongst the states. Again, this provision had two intents. The first was to just clarify in statute that the test contained two separate tests, a transactional test and a functional test. Passing either one of those tests would indicate business income. There's been some dispute in UDIPA states that the test is really just one. It's really just a transactional test, and the functional test is a subset of that transactional test. It's led to confusion in some states. Oregon is not one of those states. Majority of the MTC states acknowledge that there are two separate tests. Oregon courts have acknowledged there are two separate tests. So this provision the department doesn't believe this provision has a big impact or change things for us. But it is the MTC uniformity recommendation. The second piece of this amendment is geared at the transaction of liquidating parts or all of a business. Some courts have found that the receipts from the liquidation of a business couldn't be deemed business income because the business no longer exists. Most courts disagree with that. Most courts look at the receipts from the liquidation of a business as clearly business income. But again, there has been some confusion in some states as to whether the liquidation results in business income that would then be apportionable amongst the states. So the second amendment in House Bill 2275 clarifies that. There were two things with that. Part of it was changing business income to apportionable income, and then also mention in the statute defining apportionable income as all income that is apportionable under the U.S. Constitution and any income that would be allocable to the state under the U.S. Constitution, but that is apportioned rather than allocated pursuant to the laws of the state. Again, the department does not view these changes to the definition of business income as impacting Oregon at all. But for the sake of uniformity, as an MTC member state, we are bringing these proposals forward for your consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nuss, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was Jeff?
Yes.
Thank you. Could you explain for the non-lawyer what allocated versus apportional means? Because that, to me, seems like the key distinction here. The rest of what you explain seems to me like we're just updating, using more accurate language, but I don't know what allocated versus apportional means. I think I do, but explain it again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nost, great question, and it's one of the key questions with corporate taxation. Apportionment is business income is apportioned, divided amongst the states in which the corporation does business.
Okay.
Its income is apportioned to those states.
So if I do a lot in California, they're going to pay more tax in California versus doing very little in Oregon. That's the apportionment part.
It isn't.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nost, that's correct. And states are different in how they split things up, how they divide up that income, how they apportion it. Oregon is a single sales factor state. To your second question, allocated is what happens with non-business income. Instead of being in the pool of income to be apportioned amongst the states, it is allocable, and typically it's allocable to a single state, if it's the domicile state or if it's maybe where that asset was located. There's different rules, but typically it's allocated to a single state. There are some exceptions.
May I ask a follow-up?
Yes, please, follow-up.
So can you just give an example to you so I understand allocated. So if I sell a desk in Oregon and make money selling that, that would be allocated to our state, even though I have other business dealings in California and it may affect the bottom line in California and Oregon as well. Is that how I should understand it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, good question. I probably need to ask you some questions about the desk and how you use that desk.
So seriously, I don't know how I'm going to vote on this if I don't understand it.
No, absolutely.
That's the reason we're going to go over these pretty carefully.
Maybe a simple scenario to help explain this would be something that is totally unrelated to the taxpayer's ordinary business. So again, the two tests within defining the definition of business income is if it meets one of two tests, a transactional test, it means it's a receipt that's generated in the ordinary transactions of the business, or if it's functional, it meets the functional test, which maybe it's the sale of a desk that was used in its business, its everyday business, this desk was, but now it's a business asset that's sold. That would meet the functional test, business income.
So one more follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, please.
All right, so a desk is probably something I'm using every day. What if I have an antique car that I'm parking at the business, and I think somehow it's tied to the business, but it's clearly not part of the – would that be a better example?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, yes, let's say that's a better example, and that truly is non-business income. That income would be allocable, and typically it's to a single state. And so if it's in the domicile state of the corporation, let's say it's allocable, then that income is allocable to that state only, taxable to that state only. Non-business income gets pulled from the tax base, which is apportioned amongst the states it's doing business.
Okay. Yeah. Other questions on this particular topic, because we have several other topics. Yes, Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. How about non-operating income, say investment income? How is that allocated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, it's a good question. I'd hate to take a stab at that. No, I'd probably need to know a little bit more about the investment activities directly related to the business. I'd hate to misspeak on that. I don't think it's an obvious answer. But I'd be happy, Representative Buell, if you wanted to.
Let me make a stab at the way this thing is written. If you'll look at Section 1 of the bill, that's 2275. I've just been reading it, which is one of the reasons I had to get nudged in order to recognize Representative Nose his second and third time. If you look at the italic material on lines 19 through 22, what you see is the current definition of business income. That's in that definition section, that's sub number one. The bold language, starting on line 8 and ending on line 18, is a new definition, and it says apportionable income rather than business income means. And if you look at those, the first one, lines 9 and 10, sort of equal the first part of business income. The new language is income arising from transactions and activity in the regular course of the taxpayer's trade or business. In the current language, it says business income means income arising from transactions and activity in the regular course of taxpayer's business. So that's pretty close. Then the subsection B, lines 11 through 14, goes into all this language, income arising from acquisition, management, employment, deployment, or disposition of tangible or intangible property if those things are related to the operation of the taxpayer's trade or business. So it's directly, in other words, those things that are directly connected to the taxpayer's trade or business. The way the current rule does it is it lumps it all together and describes pretty much those same things in that one, in that first subsection on lines 20, 21, and 22. And then the new language, what it appears to me to be essentially new, is lines 15 through 18, the new language which says income that's apportionable under the Constitution of the United States and not allocable under the laws of this state, and any income that would be allocable under the Constitution of the United States but is apportioned rather than allocated pursuant to the laws of the state. Now, those four lines, those two sections, actually, they are different, aren't they? Let me see if I understand it. This is where reading law becomes really complicated, and Chris can probably do this better than I can, but let me take a stab at it. If you look at line 8, apportional income means, then it has sub A. Sub A refers to big letters A, B, and C after that. And then we have a sub B. So we have lines 9 through 16 are one kind of apportionable income. B, lines 17 and 18, is a different kind of apportionable income. And I'm going to have to actually parse this language in order to understand what it means, but perhaps you can be helpful to us to understand it. There is no reference in the current language of the definition of business income, lines 19 through 22, that uses this language about the Constitution of the United States in either the subset of A, of little a, or in the set of little b. Can you explain what that means and why the committee should care? There's probably very good reasons for it, but I don't know what they are.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you that the intent of I can tell you what the intent of that provision is, and as the reference to in lines 15 through 18, those references were intended to address a specific scenario, as I mentioned before, about the liquidation, the uncertainty among some states with the liquidation of a business and whether that constitutes business income. Most courts have agreed that it does. There has been some confusion that it can't be business income because the business no longer exists. For clarification's sake, I wanted to point out that there is a document available on OLIS, that it is a summary of these amendments put together by the MTC in 2012. It walks through. It's a very good document. It explains the work that went into this project. And it speaks specifically to each provision and the policy choices, the policy options choices for each of those adjustments, and the reasoning of the rationale for choosing the policy that they did.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative Hernandez.
For the second intent transactional test, besides liquidation, what's another example of the business income?
Mr.
Or
Chair,
non-business income.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hernandez, you would like an example of non-business income?
For the transactional test, you mentioned liquidation as an example. What's another example besides liquidation?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Hernandez, I believe the liquidation would I don't know if that would fit the transactional test. The transactional test is typically those transactions, receipts from those transactions that are part of your ordinary day-to-day operations. The functional test would fall, the liquidations would fall more into the functional test. Other functional test examples, well, the one we had mentioned previously is the sale, receipts from the sale of a business asset. But that's not your normal. That's not your primary business activity. You're not in the primary activity of selling business of these assets. But nonetheless, it's a business asset that was used in the regular course of your ordinary business, and the receipts from that sale meet the functional test, and therefore included in the apportionable tax base.
Okay. All right. And it is your understanding, I think you said, that this bill is intended to, at least this portion of the bill, is intended to update our language to conform to the MTC language that they suggested on May 3rd, 2012. And if I further understand it correctly, you don't think this has any substantial impact on the way you actually conduct business or what you expect corporate taxes to be. Did I hear that correctly, or to what extent did I get it wrong?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It is the department's interpretation that House Bill 2275 doesn't change anything materially for us. Oregon courts have recognized that the business income test consists of two separate tests, a transactional and a functional test, and we believe that the courts are clear on the liquidation of a business. Those receipts from a liquidation of a business would constitute business income.
So in that case, what's the advantage to passing a bill like this? I suspect you think there is one or you wouldn't have brought it. But
Mr. Chair, good question. Out of the sake of uniformity, the discussions that we had was as an MTC member state, and the goal of that commission to reach uniformity amongst the states, even if that is just terminology, provisions, maybe looking forward to be consistent moving forward with terminology.
Okay. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since I'm not familiar with the use of the phrase under the Constitution of the United States, can you tell us why that's there and what that does for us? I could hazard some guesses, but I'd rather have you tell us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I would probably want to bring up that MTC document from May 3rd, 2012, and look to that. What I have in front of me says the intent of that provision, that addition to the model statute, was to get at the uncertainty around liquidation receipts from the liquidation of a business and whether or not that constituted business income. That's what I recall reading from that provision, but I'd be happy to get back to you with that. It is addressed, though, in that MTC summary.
Thank you.
Great. And, of course, that is in our material for today. It's document 96093. Any other questions on this bill? The bill had a second piece. That's Section 2, I assume. Or no, maybe not. Did I get that correct, that this bill has a second amendment in it?
I don't think so.
Or is it 274 has the two.
Oh, I'm sorry. 274 has the two. Please go ahead. I'm confusing myself, and I should be quiet and let you talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, turning to House Bill 2273. As Chris mentioned, this uniform recommendation, this model proposal developed by the MTC, impacts the alternative apportionment provisions. Oregon, again, codified those UDIPA provisions in statute in Chapter 314. The alternative apportionment provisions are found in 314.667. The alternative apportionment provisions, when UDIPA was adopted in 1957, at the time there was really one primary income source, and that was largely sales of tangible personal property. You had this other subset of services and intangibles, much smaller than it is today. The focus was really tangible personal property and how multi-state corporations divide up their sales, and that was primarily the industry. The drafters of UDIPA realize, though, that not everything is going to fit into just these two categories, and so they promulgated alternative apportionment provisions, and those exist today, still in statute. What those do, it just says, if the allocation and apportionment provisions of this chapter do not fairly reflect the business activity in this state, the taxpayer may petition for, or the department may require, the taxpayer to use an alternative method, something other than what is called for. The single sales factor, maybe that's not reflecting of it. It allows for a separate accounting. This proposal makes some changes to those alternative apportionment provisions. Initially, when the MT started their process of identifying areas in need of review, they identified two issues with the alternative apportionment provisions. First, the amendment, there's two amendments they originally identified. The First Amendment reflected, clarifies the tax administrator's authority to require industry-wide and industry-wide special apportionment provisions by regulation. allows taxing authorities, the department, to issue regulations for a specific industry by rule. We have some examples of that. The MTC has adopted model regulations since adopting UDIPA. They've done this historically over time, adopted model regulations for specific industries that deviate from the standard UDIPA provisions. So this provision just codifies what they've already done in practice, places that in statute. The second piece, it preserved the authority for ad hoc relief in individual cases where the standard statutory formula or alternative apportionment regulations do not fairly reflect the taxpayer's activity in the state. Those were the two only proposals that they raised initially. The hearing officer identified three other areas that he felt needed attention in these provisions. And House Bill 2273 adopts one of those three proposals. So 2273 adopts the first two that the MTC originally identified as needing review. And then the third, one of the three from the hearing officer. The three areas the hearing officer identified was a provision relating to burden of proof. This proposal clarifies that the party proposing the alternative method has the burden of proof to show that the standard provisions do not fairly represent the taxpayer's activity in Oregon, and that an alternative method is reasonable. So again, what these provisions allow for is, if the standards don't fit, they do not clearly reflect, then here's an alternative method. So this provision says that whoever is initiating that has the burden of proof to show that it doesn't clearly reflect and that the alternative is reasonable. 2273 does not include that provision. That principle already is established under Oregon law, the burden of proof. So we're not 2273 does not have that provision included.
Okay.
Burden of proof standard is already well established. There was a second suggestion relating to the imposition of civil or criminal penalties. The hearing officer recommended, and the MTC ultimately adopted, a provision that just states that the department requires any method to effectuate an equitable allocation and apportionment of the taxpayer's income. The department cannot impose a civil or criminal penalty with reference to the tax due that is attributable to the taxpayer's reliance on the UDIPA provisions. 2273 does not adopt that amendment. There was some uncertainty with the department as to what penalties may be imposed if someone were to, thinking about this scenario and how that would work, someone files with reliance upon the UDIPA provisions that are in statute today, then the department says, boy, upon review, we don't believe these standard provisions clearly reflect your business activity in the state. Here is an alternative method. What this would do would prevent the taxing authority from imposing a penalty. As we talked through this, it seemed the one penalty that could arguably apply would be a substantial understatement of income, and that wouldn't exist if they were relying upon the UDIPA provisions. If they were following along with the UDIPA provisions, this penalty would not apply. They would have a reasonable basis to file the way they filed. Didn't see that this impacted Oregon, so it's not included in this bill.
This is true even if this is a second or subsequent correction on the part of the department?
Mr. Chair, the way I interpret this provision is that if they file correctly with using the provisions outlined in statute now, and the issue isn't that they incorrectly applied the existing standards, but they filed using those standards, and the department upon review looks and says, these provisions as outlined in statute don't clearly reflect, here's an alternative method, they would have had a reasonable basis and substantial authority to rely upon to file consistently with the provisions in statute.
So is it still reasonable if it's a second or subsequent year after the department has already told them, no, UDFCA doesn't really work in your situation, and we want this other rule to apply instead, or this other approach to apply instead? I'm not arguing about with the idea that a company is protected the first time they do it, but what if they continue doing it even after you've told them not to?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I don't believe this gets to that, but that is a very good question.
Yeah. All right, something to look at.
Yeah.
Go ahead and finish up on this.
Absolutely. And the final provision that this had was relating to the revocation of authority. If a taxpayer requests an alternative permission to use an alternative method, and the department grants that, the taxpayer shall not have that permission revoked with respect to those activities that have already occurred, unless there has been a material change or material misrepresentation of the facts provided by the taxpayer. That provision is picked up in here to just clarify when it would not be revoked. It's kind of procedurally how it would work.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jeff. Going back to the original, the main two things that triggered this in the beginning of your testimony about the comments, the original two provisions of this, of the MTC amendments, the clarifying the administrator's authority to require industry-wide, and then also the preserving the authority for ad hoc relief. You said, I believe, that that the Department of Revenue already does that. We already do have some industry-wide. Can you give us any examples of that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Madam Vice Chair, let me first start maybe with an example the MTC has, what they've done. So let me see if I can get... They have model regulations they adopted for specific industries. Broadcasters would be one of them. They talk about, so it's, they don't fall under the category. They've said the income producing activity cost performance sourcing does not work for this industry. And so they adopted model regulations and said, here's how it shall work. And said it's based on an audience factor, and that result is more reflective of the market. That's where they went. For Oregon purposes, I'm trying to think of industry-wide. Madam Vice Chair, I'm sorry, I can get that to you, though.
That's great. Even that, thank you. That actually, just even the broadcasting example, is that helps.
Madam Vice Chair, there are several industry-wide regulations that the MTC has adopted under the authority of these alternative apportionment provisions. And again, this change just codifies in statute their ability to do that, and also codifies in statute their ability to issue ad hoc grants.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up.
Yes, please.
And I also wanted to ask that and to reconfirm that this change does not, this would not impact another set of conversations we had last year and will continue to have this year about single sales factor allocation when it comes to services, the changing it to a single sales factor versus the multi-state. This is separate. This is completely separate from that. This is not at all related to that.
Mr. Chair.
Correct.
Madam Vice Chair, that is correct. These are specifically just to those provisions that speak to scenarios that don't fit in the box.
Great. Thank you.
All right. I'm not sure the language is here, but I wanted to find out whether this affects issues involving the distortion of income that comes about as a result of the various processes that are used by some companies to allocate income to corporations overseas, or not, whether that would apply in effect to our discussion of last week.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it absolutely would. These are those alternative provisions that are referenced in the listed jurisdiction provisions.
Okay.
They're found in 314.667.
Does this actually increase your authority to challenge a company that uses provisions that distort income overseas and therefore reduce income in Oregon. Does this increase your authority to do that or simply restate it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe this just restates, clarifies what these provisions do. As far as the original two proposals by the MTC, the revocation of the permit, the revocation of written permission, that is a new wrinkle to this. But I don't see that provision having a big impact on changing really what we.
Once you've reached an agreement with a business about how they're going to be taxed, it's reasonable that you stick with it unless something materially changes or unless they misrepresented the information that led you to reach that agreement. That's what this says, and that seems perfectly reasonable. Other questions on this bill? Did you finish what you were planning to say on this bill?
Yeah.
Okay. Go on. I think we have one more.
We do. House Bill 2274 contains two of the four MTC uniform recommendations, and it also has a clarifying technical fix, as so identified by the MTC. First, 2274 modifies the definition of sales. It applies the test that we just spoke to. We spoke to the transactional test and the functional test with regards to determining business income. This proposal would modify the definition of sales to eliminate functional test income from the definition. There are several exclusions already to functional test income from the definition of sales in MTC model regulations. Oregon has a couple exceptions in statute to functional type income. This provision, though, would exclude all of that functional test income and leave it at transactional test income in the definition of sales. The other piece to the definition of sales is a technical clarifying amendment. In the process of developing this process for UDIPA amendments, MTC noticed that the use of sale had two different meanings throughout UDIPA. One, it was used as a reference to the transaction itself, a sale as opposed to a lease. And then in other places, it's used as a broader reference to receipts, as is the sales factor,
And receipts would include lease payments?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry?
Receipts would include sales and lease payments?
That's correct. So receipts, Mr. Chair, receipts would include all transactions, receipts from sales, leases, licenses, rentals. And so this clarifying term is just intended to acknowledge there's two different meanings and would change those throughout the UDIPA provisions. To the extent it is speaking to the transaction of a sale as opposed to a rental, it would stay sale. In other places, it would be changed to receipt or receipts. The second proposal in 2274 was the one that the MTC identified at the beginning of this process as the one most critically in need of change, and that is the sourcing of sales other than sales of tangible personal property. So we talked a little bit about UDIP and what it did when it was adopted in 57. There were two buckets of receipts. Primarily, you had tangible personal property, and then you had a smaller bucket for everything else. Example, service receipts, receipts from intangibles. Well, that is, with globalization and with technology advances, that smaller bucket in 1957 is now the dominant bucket, and the MTC has just recognized that the original provisions, which call for sourcing dependent upon where the income-producing activity is performed, and if it's performed in more than one state, and an analysis based on the cost performance, the MTC just notified that that was the biggest area in need of revision. This proposal would move away from the income-producing activity cost-performance approach and go to a market-based for sourcing receipts, all receipts other than sales of tangible personal property. Again, in 57, when UDIPA was adopted, it said sales of tangible personal property shall be sourced to where the property is delivered or where it is shipped. And even today, so it was intended to reflect the market. Even today, that's still true. Primarily, it's going to reflect the market. There are some exceptions. There's a throwback exception that would maybe take it back to the production state instead of the market state. But for the most part, sales of tangible property still, that 57 rule still works today and reflects the market. But the cost performance provisions, there's issue with that. The MTC documented four specific problems with that provision, identifying a taxpayer's income-producing activity and determining whether particular types of costs should or should not be included in the cost of performing the activity can be difficult and contentious. There is an all-or-nothing aspect to income-producing activity and cost performance. When you get to a cost performance analysis to determine where the greater proportion of the activity took place for that item of income, the result is an all-or-nothing. It's sourced entirely to the state that had the greater proportion of the costs. The MTC just noted the all-or-nothing approach can produce arbitrary results where the income-producing activity is taking place fairly and evenly in the states. Just saying that, boy, you could have states that are very, very close, but by a small margin, the greater proportion is in one state, so that state gets the entire receipt source to it. The income-producing activity cost performance rule doesn't do what it's supposed to. It doesn't reflect the taxpayer's market. As we talked about in 57, that would have been more of a case for a market. But now services being provided remotely, it doesn't always reflect the market. The income-producing activity cost performance sourcing rule tends to source receipts to where the production states, where the cost of performance are incurred. That result was identified as duplicating the function of the property and payroll factors, giving weight to the production states, which is counterproductive for states that have adopted a more heavily weighted sales factor as a means of encouraging economic development. So the MTC has just identified four reasons why it's problematic, and they have adopted a market approach for sourcing those receipts. They break that up into four categories: the sale, rental, lease, or license of real property, the rental, lease, or license of tangible personal property, the sale of a service, and then intangible property. So they break it up into four categories and then they define the market. States have moved away from the income producing activity cost performance method, UDIPA standard, in recent years. And states got out in front of the MTC process to some extent. Some states got out in front of the MTC. MTC adopted these proposals in 2014. States had already started shifting towards a market approach before then. So you have some differences in how states define a market for these receipts as opposed to where the MTC landed on its uniformity recommendation. But by and large, three of those four categories source those receipts the same. It's really the service category where the MTC landed on a where delivered to define the market. Other states have gone with a benefit received. Wherever the benefit received for that service is going to determine where the market is. Again, the document on OLIS, the MTC summary, speaks to the policy options that they discussed and justification for the policy decisions they made for each of these amendments.
Okay. Questions on 2274? We have another witness on this bill, so Representative Dose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I understand the other two that you explained. On this one, I'm still struggling just a little bit. Does this benefit any one particular industry? Is this going to change our revenue stream, you know, up or down? What's the impact of this change? I think the other two I'm comfortable with. I'm clear about this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nost, I don't know if I could categorize the winners in one bucket and losers in the other bucket. I think it cuts both ways. There will be winners and losers switching to cost performance. I believe I've heard stories discussed here in the committee talking about in-state companies where cost performance is harmful. I'm sure there's in-state corporations that feel it's beneficial, that result. But again, the intent of this is to, this change is to reflect the market for the sale, which is the intent of the sales factor, to have those be sourced to the market as opposed to a production state.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please, yes. Mm-hmm.
So when you have it referenced to the market as opposed to the source state, that's going to be more accurate in terms of their book of business, right? So that might be a better way to do it, right? Because the market is a lot bigger than just the state of Oregon, and maybe they're operationally based here, but they're selling a lot more in other states. Is that a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Nost, that is accurate, and it does reflect what the intent of the sales factor is when apportioning income, is to give weight to the taxpayer's market for where that sale is made.
All right, one more follow-up question.
Please, yes. Uh-huh.
So are we going to hear from any witnesses who like this approach or don't like it, so I have some way to gauge if this is a good idea?
We do have one witness from the Council on State Taxation.
Okay.
Who indicates she's against the measure. So we'll find out.
But
these measures don't seem to have attracted a lot of witnesses. And
there's a whole audience out there.
They're paying as careful attention as we are. So,
Mr. Chair, please. Members of the committee, I believe I didn't see the chart that Chris referenced, but I believe there were two. Maybe a couple different maps, time maps that kind of reflected the national shift towards a market approach for sourcing these receipts.
There are, and if you go to the meeting materials exhibits, it's called DGH apportionment map, and there are actually two different ones, one as of 2008 and the second one as of 2015, and there's a significant shift. That's 2008, and the red is what we do.
God. Okay.
And now go to 2015, and you can see that it's changed quite a bit since then.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nose.
Thank you. So is someone going to... All right, the graph is interesting, but I'm not sure what it's telling me. Maybe if I had it before committee and looked at it, maybe I could formulate a question.
But we're not moving the bill today,
okay.
So there will be additional time for conversation and questions. And if the committee desires, we decide we want to go ahead, we could hold an additional hearing as part of before the work session, if that was useful. I have to say I'm a bit surprised that we didn't get more comment from a business based at least on the number of the people who've signed up. But let's wait and see till
okay.
we get through the rest of the hearing. Other questions? Thank you so much. Very much appreciate your testimony. We'd like to hear from the Council on State Taxation. And I'm sorry, I can't read your last name, so...
Dobay.
Oh, that is a B-A-Y. Okay.
B-A-Y.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
And if you'll say your name on the record as well and then give your testimony, that would be helpful. And your testimony on House Bill 2274, according to the sign-up.
Correct.
Thank you.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Nikki Dobay. It's D-O-B-A-Y. I'm here today representing the Council on State Taxation. I did check the box against 2274. We are against a specific provision in 2274. So I'm right out of the gate. Cost does not take a position on market versus cost of performance. So I won't be able to answer those tough questions. There are winners and losers. Our membership is split on this issue, so we do not take a position. What I am here today to oppose is the throw-out provision, which is included in subparagraph 6 of Section 2 of House Bill 2274. Just a side, a very quick note on the Council on State Taxation. We are a nonprofit trade association consisting of approximately 600 multi-state corporations engaged in interstate and international business. Our objective is to preserve and promote equitable and non-discriminatory state and local taxation of multi-jurisdictional business entities. Included in the written materials that I sent, COST does have a policy position against both throw back and throw out. I won't go through those policy positions. I want to limit this testimony to the specific provision in this bill and as it applies to the market sourcing proposal. Essentially what throw out does is it takes out of the denominator everywhere sales, which are either cannot be assigned to a state or are in a state where the taxpayer is not subject to taxation. So, for example, you have $10 of Oregon sales, $100 of everywhere sales. Say you have an Oregon company that's selling into Idaho where they are not taxable. Now you have to say they've sold $10 of Idaho of sales into Idaho. You now have to reduce your denominator by $10. So now instead of having a 10% sales factor, this Oregon company is going to have a higher sales factor. I'm not doing the math on that, but 10 over $90 now. And what this essentially means is that including a throw-out provision in a market sourcing proposal is essentially counterproductive to what you're trying to achieve with market sourcing. So costs submitted these similar comments to the Multi-State Tax Commission when their proposal was moving forward. But that is our general proposal. It's just a bit counterintuitive to what market sourcing is supposed to do, so we oppose that specific provision. So I thank you for the time this afternoon, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. We're looking at 2274 as Section 6.
Subparagraph 6 in Section 2.
Ah, I'm looking in the wrong place. That probably answers my question. I was looking at Section 6 because I misheard you.
So we would recommend that if this proposal were to move forward, that provision be deleted.
Any questions for this witness? It's a very specific objection. We're looking at lines 3 through 6 on that page number, page 2 of the bill. All right. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Now, having heard my comments earlier, is there anyone else who wants to testify today? Yes, Tax Fairness Oregon.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. The term everywhere sales is new to me. That has been referred to in the past as nowhere sales, and there is a difference. Because nowhere sales means it's not going to get taxed any place. And so both throwback and throw out reduce the taxes of the business and reduce the tax receipts of states as a group. According to the Tax Foundation, there are 44 states that have a corporate income tax, and the rates range from 4.53% to 12%, 4.53% in North Dakota and 12% in Iowa. Oregon's tax rate is 6.6 or 7.6, depending upon the amount of corporate taxable income. So Johnson & Johnson is a big company. They do business in pretty much every state. And they pay state taxes at the rate of 0.4%. So that's well below any state's tax rate. Clearly, they're using throw-out and throw-back provisions and to operate their sales in a way that their profits don't get taxed by states. Similarly, Berkshire Hathaway, the owner of PacifiCorp and BNSF and now Precision Cast Parts, reports that they pay 1.7% in state income taxes nationwide. They do pay federal taxes at a higher rate. They take about a 28% discount from federal taxes, and they pay maybe less than 28% of the state rates. So clearly, companies are using the differences in the states to avoid income taxes, and the throwback and throw-out rules are designed to try to curb that practice, and certainly with our low corporate income taxes, we don't need to help businesses with that. I want to remind you, and I will submit this testimony, that when corporations don't pay taxes, they're really cheating school children. And in fact, many of the largest U.S. corporations aren't paying the state taxes that should be funding our schools. So kids are the victims of that, and I urge you to make sure that we continue to tax businesses in this state. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Questions for Jody? Thank you. I don't see anyone else leaping forward, so we'll close the public hearings on House Bills 2273, 2274, and 2275, and we'll open a let's see what we have for the other three bills. I'm trying to figure out which ones to open. You're just one person? All right, so we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2277, 2279, and 2278. Kyle, do you want to give us a background update on it? And then we'll hear from Mark. Well, there he is.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And would you like me to go through all three of them?
Why don't you? Why don't you go through them all? And the more we understand before Mark talks, the less he'll have to talk. Maybe.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Well, House Bills 2277, 2278, and 2279 are all three come from the request of the governor on behalf of DOR, so they are Department of Revenue bills. However, unlike the previous three, they're not all interrelated on the same topic, so we will be hitting different topics. So I'll just step through. Beginning with House Bill 2277, the measure, it requires county governing bodies to credit property tax refunds first to the total tax liability account of the person to which the refund is owed, and then it requires refund amounts remaining after crediting the total tax liability of the account to be refunded as specified in current law. The program, essentially what the measure will do is set up more or less an offset program for the property tax system. So if you are due a refund, a property tax refund, and you have outstanding property tax liability and it's within the same county, rather than the refund check being issued back to the property owner, it would go to pay that existing liability first.
Seems reasonable.
So that's, in essence, 2277.
Okay. Perhaps what we ought to do, since these are not related, is we should go ahead and get the testimony on this one, okay, and then go on to the next one. Please.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I represent the Property Tax Division at the department. We have a number of bills this session that we're bringing forward. They're primarily administrative in nature, and this is one of those bills. You might be surprised to learn that were you to get a property tax refund, maybe for a previous year that you had in the tax court, that rather and you owed property taxes in a later year, you might be surprised to hear that you can actually still get the check despite the fact that you have an outstanding balance. And what this would do is correct that. So in most situations, the bill would require that property tax refund be used to offset any liability. And so property taxes in Oregon are paid in three payments. We have a November payment, a February payment, and a May payment. If this were to happen in December, you would only be offsetting the November payment because that's all that's technically due at that point in time. So we're not grabbing money that you maybe have seen a bill on, but you don't technically owe. We're not taking that money, only money that's actually past due at this point in time. And there are a couple situations where we've accepted out of this. Fire and act of God, that's a situation where you get a proration of taxes because your house burnt down maybe. We're not going to do an offset in that situation. And then also, if you had accidentally paid on another person's account, obviously we're not going to do an offset in that situation. You'll get that money back. Now, in those situations, we'll allow you, if you'd like, to credit your refund to any taxes that you might owe, or maybe you owe taxes on another account, will allow you to credit in those situations, but that would not be required. And that's basically the long and the short of it. We worked with the assessors and collectors on this bill, and they're supportive of it. We already have an ability to do some of this by request, so it's nothing that's going to be a big lift for their computer systems, we don't think.
Well, they haven't signed up, so we assume that they agree with you. Questions? Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often does this happen?
I don't think it happens terribly often, but anecdotally, we do know that it has happened at least on a couple of occasions. And also anecdotally, I understand that some assessors might be going ahead and applying to the balance due, although we don't think that that's technically allowed by the statutes. But not terribly often. Right. Representative Bunn, sorry.
Other questions? All right, let's go on to the next bill. Kyle?
Okay. So sticking, I guess, in numerical order, House Bill 2278, we do have a dash one amendment. That is up there in OLIS. So I'll go ahead and go through what the measure does without the dash one and then explain how the dash one changes the measure is introduced. But so House Bill 2278, it allows budget of a municipal corporation to include estimated requirements to pay debt service on bonds when the bonds were approved at a May election. And it allows, and I should even define in the background of the SMS, the term municipal corporation refers to local government districts such as cities, counties, school districts. So it's just the local government districts. But so in the case, it does allow these local governments on or before July 1st and before September 1st to adopt an ordinance or resolution that would impose and categorize the tax levy that was passed in that May to pay off the service of those bonds. And then it goes on to require the assessor to accept the local government corporation's timely filed certification of the estimated amount of the ad valorem property taxes to be imposed. So the estimated amount of those bonds, what that would have to be imposed to pay for the bonds that were passed in the May election. It also removes a requirement of historic ghost towns to comply with local budget law. In the background, near the bottom, there's the definition of historic ghost town. And one of the important parts of that is historic ghost town does not have sufficient number of registered electors permanently residing within the city to fill all offices provided under its charter. So there could be cases where to meet local budget law, you have to have a quorum, but you don't have enough people to have a quorum in the city. So that's part of the reason, that I suppose, of removing them. There's a change to the community college appropriations. It does allow them to be separated by organizational unit, the appropriations to the community colleges. And there's a series of non-substantive modifications to the local budget law statutes that are LC cleanup, essentially. The dash one does three things predominantly. It allows a governing body, the local government, to make a supplemental budget if the original budget of the local government body did not include the estimated requirements to pay the debt service of the general obligation bonds. So there's already a series of, within statute, a number of reasons why a local government can make a supplemental budget. This adds this bond bond election in May, it adds that to the list of statutes. So it's another subparagraph there. It changes the deadline that's in the 2278, the unmodified version. It changes it from September 1st to September 15th, the deadline to timely file for local government. And then it's written as it eliminates the approval requirement of the corporation, the local government, filing the written notice certified to the assessor. What it does is really, it is the assessor, when they, if the local government timely files their documentation, their changes to the local government statute, the assessor has to accept that change, and then will more or less put the imposed taxes for that bond on the roll. So it's really requiring the assessor to accept that so long as it is timely filed. So those are the three changes in the dash one.
Okay, great. So I detect this mostly, except for the ghost town provision, has to do with the timing of the assessment issues. Would you spend a minute or two describing what the rule is now and why we need this rule then to make that change?
Absolutely. Chair Barnhart, so one of the things that we do at the Department of Revenue is we have oversight authority over local budget law. We interpret the statute. We pass administrative rules. We review budgets as requested, and we review all appropriations. And so this came out of questions that we've had to our local budget law folks over the years. And so these three items are specifically things that we wanted to deal with. So specifically to the timing question, that is general obligation bonds can be passed in May election. Budgets are required to be complete. They must be adopted by June 30th, and they need to certify the taxes imposed to the assessor by July 15th. But they can't certify those taxes unless the bonds have been sold, and that's really the rub. It's kind of difficult to get the bonds sold in time to certify. You know, it's similar. You can also do operating levies in a May election, but they don't require the sale of bonds, so it's not really an issue there. This really is more of an issue with general obligation bonds. So the solution that we've come up with is something that we've been doing as a workaround for a couple years now, and it's been successful, but it's not in statute, and our local budget law folks would be more comfortable if it were actually in statute. And as it stands right now, it's a may. So the assessor may accept a late filing for a tax certification. This changes that to a shall, and then that dash one amendment changes what was in the initial introduced bill was September 1. It changes it to September 15th, which was a little negotiation that happened between some local government folks and the assessors, and that was it's pretty much the latest date that you can get this type of information to the assessor and still have them be able to meet other requirements that they have to exchange values in order to start to really lock the roll down by October 15th, or by September 25th, rather. And so that is that's basically the heart of that one. I think the ghost town issue was covered pretty well. It's impossible for them to meet the quorum requirements. There are a lot of other folks who are not required to meet local budget law. They have very simple budgets. Typically, they don't levy a property tax, maybe. And so there are a lot of carve-outs already. This would just add them to that list. And what a ghost town is statutorily defined. So we have that. And then the last bit is just, it's really just to... there's some inconsistency in the way that community colleges are able to budget versus how they're able to appropriate. And we just would like to make those, you know, budgeting the money and spending the money, we just like to make it consistent so that they don't have to convert their appropriations into a different budgeting system in order to actually appropriate. So.
Okay. Questions on Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the certification of the bond, there was a reason they did that sometime ago. Wasn't that because they wanted to make sure they actually had borrowed the money before they started collecting on it? Wasn't that the concept?
Representative Barnhart, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's my understanding, yeah, is that they want to make sure that the bond's actually sold. Yeah. And the districts would like to be able to collect the property taxes in the following tax year, because it will reduce what they'll ultimately pay for financing costs.
Sure. Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the question, of course, is what happens if there is some delay in the bond process? I've never seen that happen, to be honest with you. It always seems to go pretty smoothly. But there must have been some concern constitutionally or something that's why that sequence was set up, so that you wouldn't be collecting money for money you had not yet borrowed. I think I'm just guessing that's what's going on here. But apparently no one's that worried about this not working, and thus there must be a way that the assessors wouldn't. That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. This discussion did happen, and specifically in the context of the -1 amendment. So as the statute stands right now, it says that the assessor may accept your tax certification up until October 1st. In reality, the assessors really can't do it that late. And so they have worked in the past with some bond sellers to say, who have said, we're going to bring you a certification as of 10-1. And the assessor says, no, you really cannot do that. You have to get it to us by September 15th. And they've been able to work that out. There's been a case where it failed and the bond didn't get levied that year. So it has happened where it has not worked out. But we initially started off thinking September 1, give the assessor plenty of time to do their work. But some of the folks who are very familiar with the bond sale process came to us and said that, we have concerns that, we need every last minute to sell these bonds just because of the reason you've identified. And that's how we came up with this September 15th negotiated date. And to the bondholders, this is an improvement because it's a May. The assessor shall accept it as long as it comes in by that date certain.
Thank you.
All right. Is there a limitation on the size of the bond measure? There isn't in this bill, is there?
Well, not Chair Barnhart, not in this bill. But I think that in local budget, I'm getting a little bit out of my depth, but I think in local budget law there are some limitations on how big of a bond you can levy. But again, I'm a little out of my depth on that. I could follow up with you on that for sure.
I mean, it occurs to me, in one sense, this is a follow-up on Representative Bence's question. I'm familiar with the idea that recently, assuming local governments have done their due diligence on establishing the underwriting for the bond measure, that in many cases, at least, they're able to sell the entire bond to one entity that then distributes it to their customers, a bank, for example. Since these are municipal bonds, and therefore, for the most part, they're non-taxable to the interest is non-taxable to the bond buyer. In that situation, we're pretty well covered with for the issues that Representative Benz is talking about. If we're dealing with a situation in which you're working with an underwriter that's trying to sell the bonds for you instead of buying them all, it might get more complicated. I think it might be useful to get a little more information on the way the process actually is working now. My knowledge of this is now almost 20 years old, a time when I was on a school board. I'm getting a head nod from the other school board member. Okay. So I think it would be helpful for us to get an idea of what's changed in the way in which bonds are marketed now that makes this an acceptable and appropriate timing change. Is that a reasonable thing to ask him? Okay. Well, could you get that for us? And I think you could do it in writing if that worked. If not, we'll hold another hearing.
Okay. Representative Barnhart, I'm happy to do that. And my understanding at this point is just that they, as of right now, the very last day that they could do it is October 1, and that, again, is at the discretion of the assessor. Typically, the assessor is going to push that back to September 15th because they have to do exchange of values between districts and counties and whatnot.
Right.
And so
they have to set up the roll for the year.
So, So practically, I don't think that this is going to give the bond sellers less time than what the assessor would be willing to give them at their own discretion. And that's my understanding from conversations with both the assessors and the folks who deal with these bond sales,
so
private
let me,
attorneys.
Let me back up then just for a second. I think what you just said, without quite saying it, is that they're already doing this, and now they'd like permission.
That's true.
Okay, Representative Benz.
Sure, I think it goes a step further than that, because we're really, the word is may now, and we're changing it to shall. So that's the reason I raised the issue, because may, you had that, the assessor had the power to say no. And now we're saying they shall upon the occurrence of certain events. And I just wanted to make sure that those events could not occur unless we already had the money borrowed. You'll have to forgive me because I've forgotten how that sequence works. I just don't want to get the cart before the horse. So that's what I posted.
Okay. And Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I think I misunderstood your question at the outset. Then I thought that you were concerned that the bond sellers would not have enough time to get their work done, but your concern was actually that the bonds be sold before the taxes are certified, and this bill does that.
Okay,
this does not change that fundamental component of local budget law at all.
Fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They got to owe the money before they can levy on it.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Right.
All right. Thank you. We have one more, don't we? Yes. Let's do that one.
So the final bill you have before you is House Bill 2279. House Bill 2279, it would consolidate the property appraiser classes, which are currently 1, 2, and 3, into a single property appraiser classification. It would eliminate the appraiser certification and conduction of examination responsibilities for the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. However, it does require Department of Revenue to register appraisers and to prepare, conduct, and grade appraiser examinations. It also requires Department of Revenue to set education and experience requirements to sit for the appraiser examinations. It eliminates the requirement to first pass a general knowledge examination for persons who lack education and experience, requirements for becoming a registered appraiser. But again, that is covered by Department of Revenue being required to set the education and experience requirements. And then in the background of the SMS, I did include just some background on what it takes to become assessor right now, the test, and how that's set up a little bit. So for your information.
Great.
Chair Barnhart, so this is a bill that the department's been working on for a couple years. We've been working very closely with the Assessor's Education Committee and DAS. So currently the responsibility for administering the appraisal exam, certifying registration of appraisers, maintaining continuing education, revoking registrations, all of that split between the Department of Administrative Services and the Department of Revenue. There's been a MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, for a couple years that's been in place where the Department of Revenue is actually doing the lion's share of that work already, but there are certain spots where we will send information over to DAS, please issue a certificate to this person, they'll print the certificate, send it back, or maybe we'll say this person hasn't completed their education requirements, please revoke their certification, their registration, and then DAS will do that. So we've worked with DAS. They're completely comfortable with the Department of Revenue taking on this role going forward. And So there's a couple issues here. First of all is who does the work. The second issue is that in current statute, there's three levels of appraiser, of a property appraiser classification, 1, 2, and 3. They don't really correlate to the different levels that you might have at the county where you might have an appraiser 1, 2, and 3, or at the Department of Revenue where we have an appraiser 1, 2, and 3. So they're basically somewhat meaningless, and it creates a little bit of consternation at times at the county level in particular when folks feel like they got the appraiser 3, they should get the appraiser 3 pay, but that's not actually how it works. And additionally, the other part that Kyle mentioned was that there is a requirement in the statute now for trainees to take what's called a general knowledge exam prepared by the personnel division at DAS. DAS no longer has a personnel division. That would probably be the chief human resources officer. And then DAS does not maintain a general knowledge exam any longer. So we'd like to remove that requirement. We've been working very closely with the Assessor's Education Committee. So we have a trainee program in place. The department has set requirements for what a trainee has to do to kind of meet the standards to be able to go ahead and take the exam. We've been working with the appraiser, with the assessor's education committee on that test, where it used to be a test that was 100 questions that people had seen kind of again and again. We're mixing it up. We have a pool of questions. We're going to do it electronically, so it randomly selects questions. We've taken a lot of measures to kind of beef up this standard. We'll still be keeping things somewhat divided at the Department of Revenue between our Human Resources Department and the Property Tax Division, just to make sure that there's a good, you know, that there's not some kind of hint of collusion or whatnot. You know, we still want to keep things a little bit separate, but we believe that we'll be able to do that inside the building at the Department of Revenue. That is basically the bill as it sits.
Yeah, Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand what form of appraiser. Are these public sector appraisers that work for the counties, et cetera? These aren't the private sector appraisers that are off doing appraisals for financial institutions.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, that's exactly right. So the Appraisal Certification Licensure Board is the agency, the board that licenses private appraisers. And so that would be a certified appraiser or a registered appraiser. These are called property appraisers. And these are only, generally speaking, these are mostly public sector employees. They're allowed to testify in tax court, but not to go out and appraise a house for a loan, for instance.
By the way, Mr. Chair, have you ever looked at the requirements of what it takes to become an appraiser? It is a racket. It is an absolute racket. Conversation for another day, but if you can ever become a licensed appraiser, take it.
Take it. Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, as a certified general appraiser.
Conversation for another day.
As a certified general appraiser with the ACLB, I'm inactive now, but yeah, I definitely know that it was quite a chore to get that license, and they have recently stepped back some of the requirements on that for college degree.
Now I understand the definition of racket.
It is.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain to me the original intention of having three different levels of property appraiser designation?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, I honestly would just be guessing. I don't know what the original intention was. If you look at the requirements for the different levels, it's experience hours. And so I think that maybe they were attempting to kind of replicate something that they have at the ACLB, where they have a residential appraiser, registered residential, certified residential, and then a certified general, kind of having different levels. But again, it doesn't correspond to what your position might be at the county. And I don't think the tax court takes you any more seriously based on the number that you have after your, it's just the fact that you are.
Did I hear you correctly in suggesting that there's some kind of a continuing education requirement? I think you said that, but I'm not certain.
Chair Barnhart, so there's in the first 2 years after you seek this appraiser registration, you have to have 60 hours of continuing education, and then every 2 years after that, you have to get an additional 30 hours. And so that's something that the department currently tracks, something we've tracked for a long time. We have a great computer system for it. We do online education. We do classes out to the county. We provide most of that education to the counties as part of the Property Tax Division's role.
So if I understand, what this bill really does is remove the obsolete provision for the different categories of appraisers and moves the rest of it from statute to your rules, and of course ends the bifurcated control between you and DAS.
Chair Barnhart, I think that's correct. There's still some in the stat. There are still requirements in the statute, though. Yeah,
right.
But a lot of it would be at the discretion of the department.
Now, when you say at the discretion of the department, do you mean administrative rule or do you mean something else?
Chair Barnhart, generally speaking, that would be administrative rules.
And are those rules in force now?
Chair Barnhart, there are rules in force now. Some of them will change with the statutory changes.
Right.
We have a current set of rules now that guides a number of these items, continuing education and whatnot.
So it's, if I understand it, it's your representation that if this bill passes, the department will plans to adopt rules that essentially modernize and take the place of the things in the statute that we're going to remove.
Chair Barnhart, correct.
Okay. Anything? Oh, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that this authority is currently held by DAS and by the appropriate county civil service body. Are there, I may have missed, you may have said that no counties are doing this now. Did you say that earlier?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, the county, the assessors do have some roles. For instance, the assessor will say that someone's qualified to be a trainee, and then they might certify to us, the department, that that trainee has met the education requirements. So there are still roles for the assessor. But as far as the actual issuance of the registrations, that is not, that's done at the state level.
Please, yeah.
The concern we always have when we're 8 hours away from here is that that which we might have done locally suddenly requires 16 trips across the state. That's no good. So tell me that's not going to happen.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, that's not going to happen. And in fact, we have put, we have a plan that we've been working on. We're not there yet, but we are actually going to put kiosks in some eastern Oregon counties so that appraisers might be able to come and take this now computerized test without having to drive across the mountains.
And follow up.
That's assuming we have internet connection to those kiosks. Representative Betts.
I just want to make sure that as we move this thing or consolidate it or whatever we're going to do, we don't lose that opportunity to do locally, which has been working perfectly well, and then suddenly there are a 46-page test instead of a 2-page test. So that would be another concern, because these things tend to get a life of their own, and I guess I'm just a little worried about that. But if you'll just say again, that won't happen, Representative Benz.
Chair, no, Representative Benz, that will not happen. We've been working with the assessors on the test. I don't think it has any more questions than it would have had otherwise. And then your point is well taken, though. At the department, we hear about it from Eastern Oregon counties when we have a meeting and we don't do teleconferencing, for instance. That's a real burden for them. We've heard that message. We have been emphasizing online education just for this very reason, because it's not always easy for people to get from some of the more, you know, far-flung parts of the state into Salem. We understand that, and we have been working on that because, you know, we have partners in every county.
And final follow-up. Mm-hmm. It's, the phrase you used was, it's not always easy. It's never easy. It's a 16-hour round trip. It's never easy. So I really appreciate your concern about that distance element.
All right. And it's not in this bill, but we want to get internet everywhere in Oregon. Not just in the valley.
High speed
internet. Thank you, Representative Smith Warner. All right. Anything else on this bill? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone who wants to be heard? Having heard this testimony, is there anyone now who wants to be heard on House Bills 2277, 2279, or 2278? All right. We'll close the public hearing on those bills. And we have, can you profitably use 10 minutes on the orientation? Kyle?
I'm actually next up for property tax, so we can.
Is it reasonable to start, or should we adjourn early?
Oh, I think we ought to get rested up for that.
Really?
Let's get the heck out of here.
I think he's telling me that he wants a lump that's longer than 10 minutes to get started. Yeah. Colleagues, tomorrow we have some other additional bills that are also technical in nature, I think, and we also are going to hear the audit report on about the audit report on tax incentives. And so come prepared for those things. And with that, thank you so much for being here on time. The meeting is adjourned.
All right. What a good day. All right. What a good day.
Meeting is adjourned.